My background is a bit in occupational psychology, which is business psychology. And there's a lot of things nowadays in sort of bigger organizations that sort of say, oh, just do some mindfulness and everything, your well-being will be fine, you won't be burnt out or stressed. Which is, to an extent, that might be helpful, but also looking at the context as well. If there's some structural issues in the company or people are being overworked or not treated in a nice way or underpaid and there's high staff turnover, there might be other things in addition to mindfulness that would also need to change and sort of looking at people's well-being. Putting the responsibility on the person themselves. Oh, you're stressed. That's your problem. Sort of, you know, just do some mindfulness rather than looking at the broader picture of why someone might be struggling. You know, the mindfulness is all well and good. And as you said, there needs to be some education, some guidance on how to do it or how to best utilize it. But at the same time, also, it shouldn't be the sole responsibility of the person. There needs to be just sort of one answer for everything. And I don't think that's how it works really, right? So there's multiple things can be true, you know, at the same time. Some people can find that helpful. Some people can find something else helpful. That's all right. Not everyone needs to find mindfulness helpful either.
This episode of the Kintsugi Podcast is brought to you by Pause, Breathe, Reflect, which can help you bring mindfulness to your everyday moments. Hey there, my fellow like-hearted humans. It's Michael, and this is the Kintsugi Podcast. This week's story of connection is one worth sharing, especially if you know people who have a mindfulness practice or folks you know who might want to start a practice, but they think all of this takes way too much time. Now, I think we've all heard the doctorly advice to take 2 aspirin and call them in the morning. Although I don't think anyone really does that anymore today, but stay with me. Whatever was going on, we'd call the doctor and she would tell us, take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning. It was something to do, and she was giving time for the body to heal on its own. And if it worked, we didn't call her, but if it didn't, we called her. But her advice was very specific about dose, take 2, and aspirin have a certain milligram. So she gave us very specific directions around dose. And this topic of dose was part of my executive career in healthcare. We would talk to healthcare professionals all the time about the proper way to dose the medicines because we were trying to balance efficacy with safety. Makes sense, right? It gets to the question, how should I take this, doc? So as I started my mindfulness practice, as I was moving up to the executive suite, this question around dose was always on my mind. And if you know my story, I came into mindfulness through mindfulness-based stress reduction from Jon Kabat-Zinn. I consider him one of my indirect teachers. And today, I'm a qualified MBSR teacher, and I totally believe in the program. And the dose for MBSR was a 45-minute a day practice every day of the week. And I would often ask, why is it 45 minutes? And many times the answer I got back, well, if you don't have 45 minutes, do 44. But 45 minutes a day for most busy, active people is hard. Many people come into MBSR because they have some type of acute or chronic health issue, and they're willing to try almost anything at that point. And I know I just generalized everyone is a bit different. I know that's how I came into it. So this topic of dose, considering that mindfulness and meditation is well studied, and in particular, MBSR is very well studied with a lot of good scientific rigor with clinical trials to show the benefit of mindfulness across many different conditions. But this question of dose was always unanswered for me. Because what I saw in my program, and I still see this today, is that many people had difficulty doing a 45-minute practice consistently each and every day. And if you're starting a practice, starting from zero and going to 45 minutes can be very daunting. So as you know, with Pause, Breathe, Reflect, on our app, if you have it, and hopefully you do, there are longer practices, but mainly the app contains a lot of shorter practices because when you start a practice, it's helpful, and the research backs this up, to start with small steps that you can do consistently over time. You might know the book Atomic Habits by James Clear, and he shares some of the research on how to develop a healthy habit. My calling is, I want more people, hopefully 8 billion people on this big blue marble we all share, to have some type of mindfulness practice. But we have to develop a healthy habit first. And so to do that, it's better for most people if we start with a small step. Hence why we have so many shorter practices on our app. And in many ways, if we think about living mindfully, navigating life with more ease and bringing mindfulness to your everyday moments, I would much rather have someone do 5 2-minute practices throughout the day than 1 10-minute practice in the morning. Because sometimes that can just be transactional, part of our morning routine, and we don't embody mindful living. We don't take our practice off the cushion or, in yogi speak, off the mat and make it part of our day. So this whole topic of dose has been with me since I began my practice over 20 years ago. Then I found this week's story of connection. She's curious, she's like-hearted like you, and she wants to dive into this topic around dose as it relates to mindfulness. And as soon as I saw her work, I was like, I got to meet her. We need to bring her on the Kintsugi podcast. Let's talk about this. And I probably could have spent hours talking about her research because, well, I can be a little bit of a geek at times. And this is one topic I love to geek out about. So I can't wait for you to listen to this week's story of connection. And if you happen to be on the fence regarding a mindfulness practice because you think it has to be a certain length, like your meetings have to be 60 minutes long or a workout has to be X amount of time, with all of this, who decided? What you'll hear from this week's guest is that, in my words, you do you, boo. Shorter practices can be really beneficial. And longer practices can be beneficial as well. They may just be beneficial to different types of people. So it all works. So I can't wait for you to listen. So if you're ready, take a healthy breath in and a slow releasing breath out and get to know Dr. Sarah Strawmeyer and her work and research as it relates to dose and mindfulness. Hello, Sarah. Good to see you.
Hi, Michael. Good to see you. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Yeah. So by accent, people will pick up that you're not from New York.
Yes.
In the States. So where are you right now, just to bring listeners along?
Yeah, I'm in Australia, actually. So I'm in the future, I guess.
Yeah, you're in the future. Yeah. Is it bright?
Yes, it is. It is morning. It's a Thursday morning. It's not that warm yet, but I guess it will be getting warmer in autumn at the moment. So,
oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're like, yeah, totally different season. We're trying to figure out if spring wants to come here to the New York area, and now you get to experience autumn, which is really cool. So that's awesome. I always love to start with this. I know it's still an early morning for you, but what's the best thing that's happened so far for you today?
Oh, the best thing. I mean, aside from this, which I'm really looking forward to our conversation, right?
Yeah, of course. This is like, I don't even have to ask that. I'm just going to assume, right?
I think it's just this morning I had because I'm a bit of a coffee drinker. So I've had a really nice cup of coffee. You know, we've got those nice lattes in Melbourne. So I had a really nice cup of coffee, which is lovely. I think that's one of those things you can start the day having a coffee in the morning, which is really nice.
Very cool. And do you do anything with your coffee? Is it like, is there like a muffin or a scone or, you know, obviously Australians are known for their, I guess, their love of Vegemite, I guess. I'm not sure if that's a thing, or at least that's a stereotype that we hold here in America, that you guys love Vegemite, which I'm not sure if that's the case or not.
Yeah, I think some Australians do. I'm not Australian by background because I only moved to Melbourne in November. So I just have the coffee by itself normally as a first thing. It's just really nice. Morning ritual gets me out of bed and things like that, which is lovely.
That's very cool. It's a good, we're going to talk about mindfulness a lot. So that's actually, that morning cup of coffee can be a mindful moment, like really bringing all your senses to the cup of coffee. Yeah. So there's actually a book written by a guy here in the States. It's around gratitude. It's called Thanks a Thousand. The author's name is A.J. Jacobs. And so he's a New Yorker. And he went on this quest to thank all the people who were responsible for his morning cup of coffee at his coffee shop that he went to near Central Park in New York. And it's called Thanks a Thousand because he ended up thanking close to 1,000 people.
Wow. All of these different people, you know, harvesting their coffee, putting it together.
Yeah.
Making the coffee, selling it to him. Oh, wow. That's lovely.
Yeah. You know, transporting it from, I think, Costa Rica. He thanked the Water Authority of New York State. They supplied the water, you know, like the little sleeve on the cup and the lid. Those were two different companies. Like, he went to great lengths, and obviously the baristas and the coffee shop and the milk producers, like, he did it all. It's a pretty fascinating book. If you're into gratitude and all that good stuff, if you love gratitude and coffee, for those listening, it's a really great read. We're going to get into your work here in a bit, but I also love to ask people, if you put your work off to the side, how would you describe yourself?
Good question. I think I'm quite a curious person. Like, even outside of the work that I do, I think I quite like to know about people, about their backgrounds, what makes them act in the way they do, what inspires them or what they really like to do as well. I find that really fascinating. What they like to do for fun as well, what they like to do outside of work. You know, if they're creative people, if they like to do some art, or if they like to do some cooking or exercising, sports that they really enjoy. I think that's one of those things I really like. Like, even watching movies or TV shows, I always have a lot of questions of the backgrounds of people that are in the movies. I always like to know, what is their background like? What are those things that drove them to do these things?
Yeah, I love it.
So that's one of those things I'm quite curious person, I would say.
Very cool. So with your answer, I think it's appropriate now for me to ask, when you're not doing your work and you're not wondering about what makes other people tick, what do you like to do for fun?
I'm really into sewing things. So like, for fun, I find that really, really cool. So I sew some clothes, or sometimes I do like tote bags for friends and things like that. My great grandmother was a sewist back in the day. I never met her, but for some reason, a lot of people in my family like to do some sewing. So my mother does some. I've got lots of cousins that do it, you know, just for fun, like different things. You can sort of design your different outfit, different things. I really love doing it because it's one of those things away from the desk, away from, you know, sort of sitting and reading on the computer and things like that and working. So I really love doing that. It's quite a lovely thing to do.
Yeah, I know. I love it. Well, it's a creative outlet too, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that. My mom was a big sewer. And so, like, when I was in high school, she would make many of our clothes, which I look back now and be like, oh, that was really, like, adorable and cute by my mom and one of her creative outlets. But when you're in high school and you're wearing pants that your mom made for you, you are such not the cool kid.
Yeah.
I think I still have, like, little T trauma from that.
Yes. Oh, no. Sorry to bring that up.
We find a way to heal. So let's get into it. As I mentioned to you before we hit record, I can't put my finger on it the first time I heard you speak and as you shared your work. But when you did, I was like, I need to talk to Sarah because your work really speaks to me. Your work as a mindfulness and mindful meditation researcher. So I'd love to start there. Like, how did you get into this field? you know, you're a curious person, as you just described. I imagine you're curious about a lot of things. You could have been a researcher on a whole host of topics and interests. Why mindfulness?
Well, actually, it's a good question. And I mean, I have so many questions about all the different things in the world as quite a curious person. I used to work as a research associate in a clinical psychology institute in the UK. And one of the people that worked there is an MBCT teacher. And he did an MBCT program, which is mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And he did an MBCT program for sort of the staff and some of the students that were there. And I was part of it. I was like, oh, great program. Learning stuff, love it. So I took part in that one and I found it. So your listeners might know, so MBCT is an 8-week program, so 2.5-hour weekly sessions, right? And there's daily home practice, which it starts sort of with the body scan meditation, which is fairly long, it's like 45, 50 minutes long. And then you're asked to do that every day, right? And I really, really enjoyed it, but I found it quite intense as someone for the first time doing it. So I sort of looked into some other programs that might be there. So I completed the program, found it really good, but I struggled doing the exercises every day or the mindfulness practices just because I was working full time and then commuting after work and then cooking dinner, all of these sorts of things. Fitting in the mindfulness practice was quite difficult because of the length of the practice. And I felt really guilty not doing it as well because it was part of the program. But I really enjoyed doing it. And then I looked for other sort of mindfulness programs out there. And there was a platform called FutureLearn where universities do courses. And there was a university course from at Monash University, which is in Melbourne, Australia. And they did a program which is a lot shorter as well. So they had 10-minute practices instead of the 45, 50-minute practices. It was an online platform. So it was very different to the face-to-face, but it was online. There were some group discussions in sort of comment sections, so that they had sort of forum discussions about different things. And they had the 10-minute practices. And I really enjoyed it because I think for me, fitting it in was easier, but also learning about these concepts, I found it easier for me personally to start slow and sort of shorter practices and learn a little bit more around mindfulness practices and programs. And so I really enjoyed that. But then I kind of got to thinking as well, okay, so there's this long program that I did, MBCT, or longer program. There's also longer ones, of course. And the shorter one, you know, is a 3-week program. It had 10-minute practices. It was online. One of them was face-to-face. One was online. There's group programs. There's all of these different types of programs. And then I looked into it a little bit more and I found there's even more than those two that I did. You know, there's MBSR, and you were telling me about being an MBSR teacher before, which is the mindfulness-based stress reduction. And there's all these other types of programs, some of them online, some of them on apps, some of them in groups, some of them face-to-face, some of them using longer practices, shorter practices, the different weeks that they take, you know, different teachers, all these sorts of things. And at first I was thinking a little bit like, okay, so there's all of these different programs. How do we know which one's the good one? Because they all say this is a good program.
It's the best one ever, Sarah.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking. And I was kind of thinking, well, there are so many programs. How do I know? And I wonder if other people were confused about which one to choose. If they just happened to come across the first one, they might think that's the best one. So I thought that'll be a good PhD to do, to look at dose response in mindfulness programs and practices and looking all of these different, what I call doses of mindfulness. So things like how long is a program? Is it face-to-face or in person? How long is a single practice? Are there any other sort of practices people are doing? What type of meditation is it? Is it a walking meditation? Is it a mindfulness of the breath meditation? All these different elements. So I looked into that in my research and that's how I sort of got into learning about mindfulness and dose.
That's awesome. So you mentioned dose and we're going to get into that further. But since you mentioned it, I do want to share it. So my background, as you know, is in the pharmaceutical industry. That was my corporate background. And so dose can take on, and you sort of just alluded to it, it's a broad definition of what dose can be. You know, is it a capsule? Is it an IV? Is it a tablet? Is it an infusion? Is it once a day, twice a day, three times a day? The list can go on and on as far as like what actually the dosage, and for like Western medicine and, you know, pills and IVs and stuff, there's a whole protocol to find like the appropriate dose. You know, it's like a dose finding study that's all part of the protocol to approval here in the States, and I'm sure in Australia and in other parts of the world. So you just touched upon it a little bit, but can you expand more around when you think of dose and mindfulness, how you're thinking about it?
Yeah. And I think that's a really important question, because at first I wasn't really sure what to call it, really, because it's not pharmaceuticals and there's a bit of a connotation of dose being pharmaceuticals and pills and tablets and things. But then it's not just the amount of practice. So it's not the length of a single practice or the amount of practice. It's all of these different elements, right? So it's things like how long is the program? Like similar to how in pharmaceuticals, how often you're taking the medication, right? Is it once a day? Is it twice a day? How many times do you take it? Every other day? Every day? Things like that.
Yeah, for 2 weeks, for your lifetime.
Yeah, exactly. How much? So it's not just the amount. There's also a difference in mindfulness practice when it comes to like the cumulative amount of practice. So it's not just, you know, if someone practices 5 minutes a day for 7 days a week, that is longer than someone practicing for 20 minutes one time, right?
Yes, yes.
You know, so it's that at the end, how much do you have? So taking quite a holistic view of dose, all of these different elements as well. So I want to look into more as well who the teachers are, right? So sometimes teachers are sort of mindfulness practitioners. Sometimes it can be someone who doesn't have much of a background of mindfulness, and that can be quite difficult as well, right? Because mindfulness is one of those things where people might have some difficulty as well. And there might be some questions around that. There's also, if it's taught in a group, you know, it's quite often in mindfulness programs such as MBSR, there's group discussions of the homework, how people found the homework. Sometimes people can find that really helpful to talk about it if they're having difficulty with practice in particular. So all of these different elements, I think dose is quite a holistic term. So all of these different things like length of practice, length of individual practice, homework practices, there's also a difference in how much is recommended to practice. So saying like, you know, 6 out of 7 days a week, you should be practicing doing 40 to 50 minutes, which is often quite different how much people actually practice. And there's a difference there as well. And a lot of the time, people being asked to practice for longer quite often can mean that they don't complete it as well, because it's quite challenging, because it's quite a lengthy practice. And whether that's difference in outcomes as well, because people tend to feel quite guilty if they don't complete their home practices and they're thinking, oh, I should have done this. And then there might be a difference there between people practicing 5 or 10 minutes a day or starting off slowly like that and then increasing as time goes past as well. So there's all of these different elements of dose to consider other than the amount of a single practice.
This is all sweet magic to my ears and to my mind. As you were saying, I was like, yes, and yes, and yes. It was like, we'll continue to dive into it. If you go to the internet now, current day, it seems like mindfulness is all over the place. And everyone's like, you should do mindfulness. And then it's like, well, you should do meditation or you should do breath work. And it's like the cure-all, right? Of like, just do it all. For those that may not know what mindfulness is or what meditation is or the similarities, differences, and all that jazz, can you ground us in how you look at what mindfulness is and maybe what it isn't? So we just have a solid foundation for all of us as we go a little bit deeper into this topic.
So mindfulness is what I would quite often use, the definition is the one that John Kabat-Zinn has said, which is sort of paying attention to the present moment. And you're doing that on purpose and you're doing that without judgment as well. And what that means is sort of if you think you're doing it wrong, because everyone's mind wanders quite often, regardless of what we're doing, you know, people go on automatic pilot when they're doing things that they do a lot, like driving or doing the dishes or brushing teeth, all of these everyday things. Our minds just wander. That's just a normal human thing that we do. And then when we notice that the mind sort of wanders, which it does usually, that we sort of just bring it back to the present moment, to what we're doing at the moment, and doing that without any judgment as well. And yeah, I think that's quite a good definition, because it sort of goes with practicing mindfulness formally, as in sitting down and listening maybe to a guided meditation, or even informally. So, you know, paying attention to doing your dishes or brushing your teeth or washing your face, doing everyday things and sort of really paying attention to the present moment, really on purpose, and doing that without judgment.
Perfect. Yeah, I like to say, like, part of our pause, breathe, reflect practice, we're trying to bring mindfulness to our everyday moments. Those common moments that we don't think are really mindful moments, but really they are. Because I think from a marketing perspective, we're sort of niching or marketing mindfulness as we're going to go out and go to a retreat and detox and zen out, and it's sitting on the cushion, and that's way, and it's just focused in on the breath. But as you know, and a lot of people know, you can have fixed awareness on your breath, on sensations in the body, the soundscape. You can do a walking meditation. You can do a body scan. You can do a loving kindness. There's TM meditation. There's a lot of different varieties. You can do it by yourself with an app. You can do it in a group. So there's a lot of different ways. So mindfulness is a big umbrella, and then there's ways to like practice it. Meditation is one way to be mindful. One could probably say like journaling or another contemplative practice like gratitude is another way perhaps to bring mindfulness to your life. So I think it's much more than how it's sort of clipped into like Instagram reels and little videos and posts. It's such much more than that, you know? So you mentioned MBSR. So that was my practice. So I came to it through my recovery from my crazy accident. I had a little time on my hands. So the 45 minutes a day at that time didn't seem like too big of a burden. But as I came back into my professional life, as I got out of the hospital and stuff, I was like, God, 45 minutes a day is a long practice. And it's 8 weeks. And, you know, I know my fellow classmates, many of them, and you mentioned this, had trouble doing 45 minutes a day. And I think there was a little bit of stretching the truth, if you will, like, oh yeah, I totally did it. I'm like, are we all doing it? You know, and because I had some moments or days where I couldn't do the whole 45 minutes. And then it's 8 weeks or technically 9 weeks because there's a day for a retreat. And then there's a big fall off after that. You know, people are no longer compliant to the practice. Like it's 8 weeks, 9 weeks, and then we stop.
You're done. Yeah.
You know, the practice doesn't endure for a lot of people. For some people, it does. So as I went through my training with it, because eventually I became a qualified MBSR teacher, one of the questions I asked is like, well, why is it 45 minutes? And I considered John Kabat-Zinn, who you've already mentioned, because that's the definition of mindfulness I usually reference. So I consider him one of my teachers, although he didn't teach me MBSR directly. Well, someone who was part of the program said, well, it's 45 minutes because that's what John did.
Yeah, yeah.
So my curiosity, my scientific background from the pharmaceutical side of my life was not satisfied with that answer. So I was like, I don't know. Is it 45 minutes in one sitting? Can it be 9 times 5 minutes to get 45 minutes in a day? So that all sort of led to pause, breathe, reflect being shorter practices because I heard from so many people, like, I don't even have 10 minutes in the morning to practice. So I would share with them, I bet you have a couple times during the day where you might have 5 minutes or 5 times during the day where you might have 2 minutes, you know, just shorter chunks. And so I'd love for you to share more about what your research has concluded, or at least brought more awareness to around dose and length of time. And I'll let you share however it feels comfortable to share.
First of all, I think there's different things as well with what you said as well. So I think there's a difference on how people start off with mindfulness. So doing 45 minutes when you first start off is, I found, very difficult, and others found that as well. So one of the metaphors I sometimes use is like, say, someone's wanting to run a marathon, right? Imagine someone running a marathon and they've never done any jogging before. You wouldn't expect that person to run the whole marathon the first day they'd ever put on their running shoes, right? You'd expect them to maybe do 1K and then maybe 5K and then carry on until they reach that longer running. Otherwise as well, there's also lots of research that says in public health, you know, you just do 5K 3 times a week is actually really good for your physical and mental health as well. So not everyone has to run a marathon or go to the Olympics as well, right? So different people find different things helpful. But for a lot of people, starting small is quite helpful as well, which is really interesting from what you've said. For my research, what I found, so what I did is look at all of these different studies that were published using mindfulness-based programs. So that includes MBSR, includes MBCT programs. It also includes online programs, adjusted MBSR, MBCT programs. So it includes programs such as MBCT, MBSR adjusted for certain populations. So maybe some research, for instance, did MBCT with cancer patients. So they had shorter sitting practices to accommodate for people who found it difficult to sit longer. Sometimes also, you know, there was MBSR with dementia patients, you know, where they've changed the wording around things to make it easier to understand. And then there were all of these other types of programs. So there were much shorter programs, you know, 1 week programs, 2 week programs. There were online programs, there were face-to-face programs, there were app-based programs. There's all these different ones. And all of them had to follow a definition of mindfulness that was outlined by Rebecca Crane on what constitutes a mindfulness practice. So it's not things that don't follow that definition of John Kabat-Zinn I mentioned earlier. So in the end, I had 203 different programs. And I did what's called a meta-analysis and meta-regression, where I looked at comparing all the doses. So first of all, I checked at whether generally mindfulness is helpful. You know, mindfulness-based programs are helpful for depression, anxiety, stress, and, you know, trait mindfulness. which ended up being the case, which is good. And then I looked into dose response relationships. So whether the more you do, the higher doses of all of these different things, like length of programs, contact with a facilitator, length of practice, the amount of home practice, etc., whether that meant the more you do, the better the outcome. And really surprisingly, because this is not really what the theory said before, other researchers said before, I mean, no one had really compared all of them before. Basically, what I found is that generally there was no dose response relationship. That means that longer, more intense doses were just as helpful as less intense and shorter doses. And that was the case for depression, anxiety, and stress outcomes. Now, for trait mindfulness, so how mindful people are in everyday life, regardless of whether they practice or not, more contact with a facilitator and greater intensity of a program was found that increased trait mindfulness a lot more, which kind of makes sense because that's the thing you're learning. So if you've got a teacher teaching you and if that's more intense, that's the case. But generally, there was no dose response relationship comparing all of these different studies. I then started looking at it a little bit more specifically. So looking at the different doses separately in sort of experimental research. So I compared two different lengths of mindfulness practices over 2 weeks, two sessions a week with people. And what I found there is actually briefer mindfulness practices, so 5-minute mindfulness practices for these people who were novice mindfulness practitioners. So really important to note that they were not mindfulness experts or someone who's practiced for a long time. So that's the first time they would have done any mindfulness practice. So for them, actually briefer mindfulness practices were found more helpful for their levels of depression, anxiety, and stress, sort of general population levels, which was really interesting. So people seem to have found it easier to start mindfulness practices or something more helpful if they're started with briefer practices, which is really interesting in this sort of population as well.
Very interesting. Wow.
Yeah, there's also an interesting thing. Actually, there was one person who was randomized to a 20-minute mindfulness practice who seemed to really struggle with it. She was sort of shifting in her seat and sort of asking, isn't there a shorter version available? Because she's finding the 20 minutes really long to do when first practicing as well and things like that. Which is really interesting because that's not really what was found or I've seen found in much other research.
Yeah, that's also interesting. I think sometimes for the longer practices, I think one of the harder things to measure is just the quality of the practice as well. I imagine as a researcher, that's really hard to determine. As you mentioned, the mind wanders. Even experienced meditators, as they sit, their mind's going to wander. And the tension in coming back to that point, that anchor, if you will, or that touchstone is part of the practice, right? Our mind wanders and we come back. So that's all part of it to pay attention in this moment. Correct me if I'm wrong, it's really hard to assess the quality of the sit, whether we're talking about 5 minutes, 20 minutes, or 45 minutes.
That's so true. It's funny that you mentioned that. I'm actually currently doing some research looking at quality of practice.
Oh, wow, cool.
Yeah, but I'm happy to share that with you as well. I mean, we're still collecting data at the moment, but that's one of those things, right? You don't know what people are doing during the mindfulness practice. There's only so much you can find out, I guess, even with a measure or anything like that. But yeah, absolutely, the quality of mindfulness practice is really important. So what people are actually doing during the practice, are they following the guidance? Are they paying attention on the present moment and things like that? Are they doing it in the right way as well as important? But yeah, absolutely, that's an important thing to consider.
All right, now it seems like a good time to pause and take a break. To pause, breathe, reflect. And when we come back, Sarah and I will continue our conversation around dose. All right, let's take a break. Take a full breath in and a slow releasing breath out. And relax the body as you soak up our conversation. Ah, I hope that felt good. Okay, now that we're a little bit more relaxed, can we be real? I think our morning routines, well, they've gotten a little out of control. You might not have time in the morning to meditate because you're busy doing other things like trying to get to work or getting the kids off to school. And this is where my app, Pause, Breathe, Reflect, comes in because I built it for busy people with a whole bunch of shorter practices. So if you don't have 10 minutes in the morning to meditate, cool beans. You're human after all. But I bet you have 5 times throughout the day when you have 2 minutes to practice and let go of stress and bring mindfulness to your everyday moments. So today, download Pause, Breathe, Reflect for free and begin to stress less, sleep better, and join a community of like-hearted humans rippling something worth rippling into the world. All right, let's go back to our conversation and celebrate the kintsugi within us all. Do you know the book Atomic Habits by James Clear?
Oh, yeah.
As you're talking about, you know, shorter practices is a good way to develop a habit, his book comes to mind because as he talks about habit creation, it's, you know, trying to have as little friction as possible, you know, small steps, if you will. And even as a baby takes their first steps, those first small steps is, you know, toddler steps, they're still working at it, right? So even a 5-minute practice takes a lot of work for a practitioner, but it's that ability to do the practice and then come back again the next day and do it again. So we develop some consistency to your point. And this is my experience. The 45-minute practice for MBSR, most of the people coming into that, they're dealing with some type of acute or chronic illness. So there's a relatively big why as to why they're there. And, you know, for everyone else, sometimes that why, like, why are we doing the practice has yet to be defined, which I think is an important part of, like, what do you want to get out of a practice, whether it's a 5 minutes every day or 45 minutes every day. I think grounding ourselves there is really important. I'm not sure through your work, if you've found having a clear why or intention behind the practice, does that help at all for people to develop a more consistent practice?
I think so. And I think it's very different from person to person. Yeah, I don't think that one size fits all approach will work for everyone because people are so different, right? Even any other thing that you're doing, it's sort of not like, oh, just do half an hour of mindfulness and then you'll be fine. That wouldn't apply to everyone in the right way, right? So there's also different types of practices might work differently for different people, depending on their difficulties as well. So I think that starting small can be helpful for a lot of people. And then that can be changed. But also, I think for some people, longer practices can also be helpful to start with, right? There's quite a lot of the time, I think in psychology or in the world in general, there needs to be just sort of one answer for everything. And I don't think that's how it works really, right? So there's multiple things can be true, you know, at the same time. Some people can find that helpful. Some people can find something else helpful. That's all right. Not everyone needs to find mindfulness helpful either. So, you know, there's different people can find different things helpful, I think is a really important thing.
That is such an important part of the message. And this is exactly how I feel. Like, the world's big enough. What do we have? 8 billion people on this planet. There's not just one way, right? If anything, if we go back to the Buddhist underpinnings, like, obviously Buddha has like the Eightfold Path, like the right way, but there's like, it's finding the right way that is in alignment to you, right? So there can be, to your point, just like running, there are multiple ways to be a runner. You know, you can be a jogger, you can be competitive and do a 5K or a 10K or a marathon, or do an Ironman, you know, add other things to it, or do an ultra run like of 100K. And so I sort of see mindfulness a little bit in that way too. Like, shorter practices can be really wonderful. Like, if you just did a 5-minute practice every day, it's sort of like doing a 3K or a 5K every day. It's really healthy. And the research suggests that's a really healthy practice. And then on the other end of the spectrum are folks that love to go to like 14-day silent retreats, which can be really amazing for them. But to me, it's the analogy I like to make. It's sort of like doing an ultra marathon. And more isn't necessarily better. If you're running a 5K and you think, no, I got to get to this like 100K race, that's where enlightenment is found. It may not be the right type of race or run for you, just like you might be really happy with a 5-minute practice, and doing a 7-day silent retreat may not necessarily be the right ticket for you. And that's okay, right?
Yeah. And I think that there's a lot of this sort of thing that oh, just do this, just do a bit of mindfulness and you'll be fine, you'll be sweet. is also quite dangerous, actually, because for some people, there can be some adverse effects of mindfulness. I know before we spoke a little bit about Willoughby Britton's work with the Cheetah House, which is sort of looking at exactly that sort of adverse effects that mindfulness can also have, which I think is, again, another reason why it's really, really important to practice mindfulness in a way that is from qualified teachers such as yourself, right? So someone who has practiced mindfulness or who has studied it a little bit rather than, I mean, nowadays, there seem to be a lot of social media influencers practicing mindfulness or saying, oh, you just do it like this, which I think can be quite dangerous, actually, for people because of the adverse effects. And also because I think it really isn't for everyone either.
Yes.
And that's all right. And in the same way.
Yeah. Just like Western medicine, a pill isn't for everyone. It doesn't, you know, aspirin doesn't work for everyone, which is totally fine. And mindfulness doesn't work for everyone. And there can be side effects. And yeah, so what's happening with Cheetah House, I think, is important work to let people know, like, one, be mindful or be thoughtful about why you want to start a practice and what kind of practice really speaks to you. And it could be, it could just be simply a loving kindness practice where you're not even placing your focus on your breath. It's more mantra, or you may just want to be in community. You know, that's one of the things we do at Pause, Breathe, Reflect. So loving kindness is a cornerstone practice, as is a body scan. Those helped me through my recovery. We have the app, but I also lead live practices throughout the week because practicing together can be a really meaningful experience. There's something about, I think, our energy when we're together, even if it's just a Zoom, we can pick up on each other and we realize that we're all going through something. And mindfulness can be a really wonderful tool for a lot of people, but it's not the panacea or the cure-all that I think many teachers out there today claim it can be. I think that's a little dangerous and maybe irresponsible. Like I had my practice for almost 2 decades before I really finished up my teaching training, because I wanted to bring a life of experience as a practitioner before I was going to teach someone how to do mindfulness. That's just my thing. It's just how I wanted to show up as a teacher. But I think current day, there's a lot of people out there that are like breathwork experts or meditation teachers. And I just worry because it can be such a valuable resource and tool for folks. But as you mentioned, it's not for everyone. And teachers should have some base of like trauma-informed education that goes along with their teaching.
Absolutely, yeah. And also, I think a lot of the time, like by what you're saying with the panacea of mindfulness, so that mindfulness is almost like a plaster that you can say, oh, if there's a problem with your organization, just do some mindfulness, you'll be fine.
Yeah, just breathe.
Yeah, just breathe. Because my background is a bit in occupational psychology, which is business psychology. And there's a lot of things nowadays in sort of bigger organizations that sort of say, oh, just do some mindfulness and everything, your well-being will be fine, you won't be burnt out or stressed. Which is, to an extent, that might be helpful, but also looking at the context as well. If there's some structural issues in the company or people are being overworked or not treated in a nice way or underpaid and there's high staff turnover, there might be other things in addition to mindfulness that would also need to change, and sort of looking at people's well-being in the sense of, are they, you know, getting home in time to see their families or something like that as well, which is also important. So it's not just mindfulness, is sort of in the context that it operates in, that's really important as well.
Oh, that's such an important topic, Sarah. I could riff on this for a bit. I might, and I just would love to get your reaction, because I do think what I can speak to is corporate America. I'm assuming that maybe corporate life in Australia might be the same way, or in other Western countries. I think corporate America in the US is actually doing a disservice to mindfulness. To your point, like the infrastructure, the setup of the work environment is unhealthy, and they might create like a pod that you can go practice in, or a silent room or a quiet room, and say, I just go there and just like zen out. But they're not really addressing how the work is actually getting done. And to your point that you just made, if people are working around the clock and they can't see their families and they can't have family dinners, which is about community and belonging, the practice or offering the app to them through their company benefits or having these quiet rooms is sort of like window dressing on a house, but the foundation isn't solid. And what I've seen with a lot of companies, especially through the pandemic, you know, we've gotten more comfortable talking about mental health is health, which is great through the pandemic. But I think we're sort of connecting mental health and meditation apps with like, oh, you have anxiety. We offer this app through our benefits program, but without any type of guidance or coaching or teaching around it. It's just like, here's a fishing pole, go out and fish. And we're not going to teach you actually how to do it. And it never gains traction because people need some type of guidance to do really any type of practice. And I think the consequences can be harmful, actually, because people have tried it and it's like, it doesn't work for me, but it didn't work because they didn't have the right support, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in addition to that as well, is the whole putting the responsibility on the person themselves. Oh, you're stressed. That's your problem. Sort of, you know, just do some mindfulness rather than looking at the broader picture of why someone might be struggling. You know, the mindfulness is all well and good. And as you said, there needs to be some education, some guidance on how to do it or how to best utilize it. But at the same time, also, it shouldn't be the sole responsibility of the person if there are some larger structural issues, and it shouldn't be sort of put on them as well.
Yeah. And it shouldn't just be niche for like, you have anxiety, try mindfulness, because mindfulness can be really helpful in a lot of different areas of life and work life. I believe we can't really have diversity, equity, inclusion, and cultures of belonging in corporate life without some type of mindfulness component to those initiatives. Because back to the definition of mindfulness, it's paying attention. So part of it is paying attention to our colleagues and seeing them and hearing them and appreciating them. I think we could do a better job here talking about mindfulness in corporate life, and that I think it can change how we work together. And since we spend so much time working at work here in the States, it can change how we live together, you know? So that's my hope. And I'm trying to encourage people to just take a moment, 2 minutes, maybe five times a day, just hit pause, take a few breaths, and then use that period of reflection, that space, to be thoughtful about how you want to move forward. I so love the work that you're doing. I want to ask, you mentioned it earlier, what gets you excited about the future and future research? You mentioned the quality of a practice, but are there other areas of interest that you have that we can anticipate reading about one day?
Oh, yeah, I think there's so many things. There's heaps of stuff. What's interesting in research, for me especially, is you do a piece of research, like a PhD research or postdoc research, and then there's so many more questions to answer, right? So all of these different doses I wanted to look at as well, that explored sort of looking at comparatively across different programs, but then also looking at, okay, taking each one individually and sort of seeing, okay, what is going on there? What is the most helpful one? And I also really want to look into individual differences on what people find helpful. So what type of doses do people find helpful individually and why? Some difference there, some sort of differences with long-term practitioners as well. Some differences in sort of the types of practices that people are doing. You know, we spoke a bit about mindfulness of the breath and loving kindness and body scans. Also, if there's a difference in individuals, what type of practice they might find most helpful as well, which one of those. Again, going towards this whole concept of not everything works the same way for everyone at the same time as well, right? So I think that's a really important thing to consider as well. So there's lots of things and questions I want to explore with the dose component.
I can't wait to see, as we've talked about, this is a topic that fascinates me. I see a lot of people doing, not just in mindfulness, but they'll take a big bolus of whatever, exercise or study, and they're like, I'm just going to do a massive amount. As a cyclist, you know, I see a lot of people like doing this, like a really long ride, like 5 hours long on the weekend. And through the rest of the week, they're spent, they're toast, because that ride exhausts them. They would have been much better of doing like an hour for 5 days in a row than one big 5 hour chunk. And in the US, we think, well, more is just better. You like that sandwich? We're going to make the sandwich bigger. You like fries with your sandwich? We're going to give you an endless supply of fries. Like, we live in a country where we believe that more is always better, but it's not necessarily better. So this topic around dose and all the variables of it completely fascinates me. And I'm so glad you're doing this research, because this was an area of frustration for me as a practitioner and as a student becoming a teacher. I could never get a really clear answer, because what I saw happening was what was being prescribed to people was far too long of a sit for most people in their active lives, so they never did the practice. So my feeling is, if 5 minutes a day allows you to do it every day and have a practice for life, I think that might be a good thing for you. I'd rather see that than have you go crazy and do like an hour a day for 3 weeks and then never do it again.
Absolutely. And I think that there's a whole component. There's some research standing. I mean, there isn't much on those, right? Which is quite surprising, I thought, when I first started looking into it. But there's also a thing about the difficulty it brings when people aren't being asked to do too much too soon, because it can bring that challenge, that sort of guilt with them, which then might be a boundary to keep practicing, even in briefer practices. So, you know, there might be actually quite negative effects if it's too intense too soon and it doesn't feel right for the person, such as for adverse effects, but also maybe for continuing to practice. So someone might not want to continue to practice because it seems too hard. And they felt like they're not doing it right, and they had some guilt associated with practicing as well. So maybe starting slow. I mean, for some people, that works and that's all good. There's loads of correct answers there. But also for some as well, it can be quite difficult to continue practicing if you feel like, oh, I need to do like a long practice every time.
And being true to who you are, right? You know, we get into this comparison trap on a whole variety of different topics. And so if you have a friend who happens to be practicing longer or even shorter, and you have your practice, both are good. If they're helping you live mindfully, if they're bringing a sense of ease as you navigate life and maybe greater awareness or better focus, like in the spirit of you do you, boo, pick the practice that works for you. And if it's working for you and you're getting the benefit that you want out of a practice, going back to the why, then I think that's the perfect practice for you.
Absolutely. And it's the whole not one size fits all. And it goes with loads of other things, you know. I mean, if we're thinking about food, for instance, some people might be allergic to nuts or something. They might not be the person that should be eating lots of nuts, even though they're quite healthy. You know, people are just different in what they find helpful. And I think that's all right. We don't need to force everyone to be finding the same thing. I think it's good that there's diversity and there should be more conversations about these things, especially when it comes to things like mindfulness as well. There's different ways of doing it that people might find helpful.
Yeah, you mentioned food. That's another big one. Like, we can get very judgmental about food choices and what we think is right. And, you know, everyone has like different DNA and comes from different places on this planet, and they have different allergies, as you mentioned. And we can do a whole other show on that one day, Sarah. So like, but yeah, if we could ease the judgment and just be true to like what practices make sense for us, I think we can create a more peaceful planet. Is there anything that I didn't ask you but should have?
I don't think so. I think we've covered quite a few things. I mean, I could probably talk about this for a very long time. So there's also a constraint of, you know, the time. But yeah, I think it's really, really interesting as well. I think having this conversation with you is actually really, really helpful for me, because when I first started looking into it, there wasn't that much agreeableness or thinking about why you're doing this research. You know, because it's fairly, I don't know what would be the right word. So it's not quite what people would expect, right? So it's a bit of a weird finding that I found in my research so far, that there is no dose response. The more isn't always better, especially early on. And it's not to say that there's anything wrong with MBSR and MBCT. They are really helpful. There's lots and lots of research saying that those sorts of programs are really helpful. But other programs can also be helpful. And those shorter programs, what you're doing is also helpful, right? So there's just multiple things can be helpful at the same time, you know, and that's okay. And different people can find different things helpful. I think that's the really, really important part. And this is why I think conversations like this, or what I did at Cheetah House, for instance, is really helpful to sort of get that conversation going outside of doing the research in academia and some people read it and things like that, but sort of getting these conversations out. And I'm always keen to hear what people think in general. There's lots of people that might know a lot more from their own practices. And I've had loads of conversations. I had a really good conversation recently with a Buddhist monk about all of this. And he was sort of saying similar things to what I found, which I found fascinating. So there's loads and loads of conversations. I think it's really, really important to keep that conversation going about all of these different things.
That is so cool. It's really cool that you had that conversation with a Buddhist monk and there was some similar themes. And yeah, I will underscore, because MBSR was so helpful for me in my recovery. And there are a lot of folks that are members of our Pause, Breathe, Reflect community that have gone on to take MBSR. And I think it's a fabulous program for those where it's the appropriate fit.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, to your point, like we can have a lot of truce, a lot of yes, and there's a lot of different ways to practice this. So I'm going to dub myself, Sarah, your number one fan in America. I'm not sure if you have already anointed someone to be your number one fan in America, but I'm a fan of your research. And
oh, thank you so much.
I am fascinated by it. And I'd love to continue the conversation as your research evolves and more findings come, because I think this is a very important topic to continue to examine, you know, just around the benefits of mindfulness, the side effects of mindfulness, and the quality of a sit as well as the dose. So my encouragement to you is keep on being curious. And I so appreciate you coming on the podcast and sharing your research with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And this is great. These conversations are so interesting for me. I was really looking forward to this as well. This is really great. And also love the work that you're doing with Pause Brew Reflect. And also sort of getting these sort of podcasts out there and the idea of Kintsugi, I think, is fantastic as well, to put that in a podcast. I think that's great.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so it's, you know, for me, it's where I see us as a planet. We may crack and we might feel cracked right now, and we might be cracked and break. That's part of our human experience, but we can find a way to come together. And those golden scar lines in Kintsugi are symbols of our strength. So I believe that mindfulness is a tool that can help us reconnect our pieces. It may not be the tool for everyone. The Urishi that is the lacquer that brings the pieces together is different for everyone. We just got to find our own formula or our own recipe. So what I'm hoping through Kintsugi is that people can see their gray hairs, their wrinkles, their scars as these symbols that I've lived, and I've lived a wonderful story. So thanks for referencing that. How do people find out more about you? Where should they go to discover more about your work?
I think it's also with the Kintsugi, real quick, when you say that, I think it makes the bowls also look more interesting, especially if they're individual, right? So they look more interesting in that sense. Where people can find me, so probably on Twitter, it's just at Sarah Jeremiah, which is my name, or LinkedIn as well. I also have my own website where I sort of post things that I do or I research as well, which is sarahpsychology.com. And those are probably the best places to find me.
Very cool. Well, we'll put all that in the show notes. And thank you again. Thanks for putting a good ripple into the world, Sarah. And I'm so glad we've had this time to connect and talk about mindfulness and dose. So thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me.
There you have it. A little bit more information about dose. I just love Sarah's energy, her curiosity, and of course, her research. And I would love to know what you took away from our conversation. For me, it goes back to what I said up front. You do you, boo. A one-minute practice can be really beneficial. And for those that like to do an ultra, a seven-day silent retreat can be very meaningful to those people. In many ways, it comes back to the timeless question in mindfulness, what's called for now? As we think about what kind of practice is needed right now. It might be a short practice, it may be longer, could be a movement practice, a body scan, TM, you name it. Again, you do you, boo. So I think what's called for is for us to ease our grip on this absolute. It's got to be X amount of minutes or it's not going to be effective. I don't know if Buddha said it had to be X amount of minutes. What he was trying to do was to invite people into a pathway towards enlightenment and living mindfully. So by doing shorter practices throughout the day consistently, like with Pause, Breathe, Reflect, if that can help you live mindfully, you might be on your right path. And you might never have to do a 3-day, 5-day, or 7-day, or longer silent retreat. So find the practice that's meaningful to you, one that you can do consistently and really embody into the way you wish to live, the way you want to show up, which then will put a much better ripple into the world. I want to thank Sarah again for coming on the Kintsugi podcast. To schedule this was a difficult thing, but as you know, I often say you can do hard things. We were dealing with all the clock changes and time zones because we're in different parts of the world, but we did it, Sarah. So thanks for joining. And I'll put all the different links so you can connect with Sarah and learn more about her work around dose and mindfulness. And I also want to thank you for coming into our space. I know time is your most precious resource, and I'm very grateful that you decided to carve out some time in your day to listen to our conversation, and I hope it was meaningful for you. And if you haven't already, I would love it if you could leave a kind review or rating wherever you happen to listen to podcasts. And share this episode with a friend or two. Because as we dance with the algorithm, that's all part of our lives. One of the best ways to gain some type of control is to share beautiful ripples into the world. And Sarah's work is a beautiful ripple worth sharing. So I hope you'll do that. And if you want to stay connected with me throughout the week, you can sign up for the Ripple Effect on my website, michaelobryanshift.com. And there are a bunch of other resources there to help you in your professional life or personal life, navigate life with more ease and prevent a bad moment from turning into a bad day, which is a really cool thing to do. So thank you for being here. I appreciate you. Also, I'd like to give a shout out to the like-hearted humans at SaaSPod that make the Kintsugi podcast sound so great and help it ripple into all corners of this big blue marble that we all share. And now, I want to thank you for listening and supporting the Kintsugi podcast. And if you want to go above and beyond in your support, I could certainly use a kind rating, a review, subscribing, or sharing, because it does something to the algorithm that I don't completely understand. But when you engage in this way, it helps others find our like-hearted community. If you've already done so, thank you for the extra support. And if you haven't done so yet, today might be a really good day to do so. And if you'd like to receive some additional resources that can help you connect with yourself and others, like my Better Life workbook and the inspirational text messages I send throughout the week, and of course, our Pause, Breathe, Reflect meditation app, I'll put those links in our show notes. And remember, between now and next week's story of connection, when you have a challenging moment, slow down, come back to your breath, and know that you've got this and we've got you. And together, we will ripple something worth rippling into the world. I love you for listening, and I hope to see you next week. Until then, toodaloo.